This is Dialogue. Dialogue, a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.
And this is Dialogue Assassination with political research specialist Mae Brussel. I'm Phil Kogan, and we welcome you to another edition of Dialogue Assassination. Mae, of course, the major story, one of the major stories of the week, has been the death of J. Edgar Hoover. And, of course, newspapers around the country and around the world, radio stations, TV networks, have all reported the death of Hoover. And nobody until now has mentioned...
Do you dare say it, Phil?
A conspiracy.
To kill J. Edgar Hoover? Should we try that one today? We're going to throw it out.
So that's what you're going to try today, right?
Well, we're going to do... This is called the obituary for J. Edgar Hoover. We're going to do a program on J. Edgar Hoover because we've talked Dialogue Assassination for almost a year, Phil, and... Everything that we've mentioned on each of the programs can be related back either to the Central Intelligence Agency or the FBI. Almost every aspect of material that I bring in has to do with agents of the FBI like Lee Harvey Oswald or the Central Intelligence Agency. And Hoover is very important in the political assassinations. So I think we'll talk about J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover had a love affair in his life. I'm finished reading a book by Hank Messick called John Edgar Hoover. And Hank Messick is the man who's written many books on the syndicate and crime. And this book is The Relationship of Hoover to Organized Crime. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the one person that he had a love affair for, according to Messick, was Shirley Temple. And I loved Shirley Temple when she was little. So I want you to know that Hoover can't be all bad. He may be mad for the next 59 minutes of this show, but for 1 minute, he can't be all bad if he likes Shirley Temple. That's the one thing we had in common, J. Edgar Hoover and I, was we liked Shirley Temple. And outside of that, we'll get right on to the subject of J. Edgar Hoover with the usual format that we have, Phil. I'll take the news of this week as it came out, and we'll go relate it back to his death and his contributions to this country.
Again, that's sort of the format of Dialogue Assassination. Each week you relate the news to political assassinations and the assassinations of Kennedy, the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King, and tie it together as to maybe establish a pattern that keeps reoccurring.
When you talk about assassinations, Phil, you have to remember that in order to gain power, and we're talking power of the world or the mineral and the oil and the resources, I refer to them as the goodies of the world, every person that stands in the way of the power is expendable, even members of the team. And we're going into that, maybe Hoover died a natural death and maybe he had a little help. He was certainly expendable at this moment in history.
Well, he was also old. I mean, he was sort of...
He was 76.
It was about ready for him to die.
Well, there was enough coming out about him to give him a heart attack. But I'm wondering how much of that was put out to... put him down at this particular moment in history where Richard Helms stays high and mighty. Nothing is written about the Central Intelligence Agency, and I'm going into that too. The FBI is going to get a new director temporarily, Richard Nixon said this week, and he's appointed Assistant Attorney General Patrick Gray, who will be the new director until after the elections. Now, the media is very conscious of the fact that the elections could be affected by a new controversy. Richard Nixon knows that, and the newspaper people asked him, if you lose the election, would you appoint the new director in the interim between the new president? And Richard Nixon was caught off guard, and he said, we're not thinking in those terms, quite frankly. So they pressed him further that if he lost the balloting, would he attempt to fill the FBI post? And he committed himself and said that he wouldn't. And this is pinning him down. People are getting smart. Even the carefully screened newsman in the White House got this question out and pinned him down. It's very important that the man who's taking temporary head of this particular agency is from a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, because the chain of command in the political assassinations comes from Navy intelligence, from CIA to Defense Intelligence Agency through Navy intelligence. And Richard Nixon was part of this Navy intelligence group, and almost every appointment he makes has to do with Navy intelligence. So the man who is getting the post temporarily in, he's a friend of Nixon's for the last 10 or 12 years. He'll be the temporary director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, but save your biographies on him and follow it through. Now, before J. Edgar Hoover died, on last Saturday's program, I talked about the War Council. Remember? For people who listened last year, the War Council was Richard Nixon flying into Texas to be with John Connally. Nixon goes around a lot of places now, and he has a lot on his mind. But he took his helicopter from Randolph Air Force Base to San Antonio and visited John Connally for those 25 electoral votes in Texas. I have said that since 1963, November 22nd, this is a one-party system. You know, Richard Nixon didn't take a motorcade through Texas for those electoral votes. You notice that. He took a helicopter. He didn't, when they told Lyndon Johnson, when Lyndon Johnson told Kennedy, you have to come down in Texas. This was in May or June, El Paso Hotel. It was Clifton Carter and his other aides. They said, you have to come down in Texas in the fall. They pressured him. This is the way for the Democrats to get Texas. They waived those electoral votes, and the decision was made that early summer that he would be in Texas in the fall. But when now we have John Connally, the Democrat, offering the 25 electoral votes to Nixon, the Republican. No motorcade. He doesn't have to do the kind of campaigning that John Kennedy had to do to get those electoral votes. And notice how the party lines are crossing over. You know, they're entertaining with this big barbecue. But I called it the War Council, that meeting, and I refer once again, for some of you who've never heard my shows, to a book by Penn Jones called Forgive My Grief. Penn Jones has written three books on the assassination. This is from Volume 3 of Forgive My Grief, in which he said, on November the 21st, 1963, in Dallas, Texas, the assassination of Kennedy was more important than the Normandy invasion, and a conference was held for the Dallas Project. I'm reading this part of the book because J. Edgar Hoover attended that party. This one he wasn't invited to. He was about to decease from this earth. But at this War Council meeting in the garden of Clint Murchison, at the home of Clint Murchison, there was a conference of Richard Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover where all the major forces of this country were involved and had to be accounted for. Killing the president was the most important takeover of a country in world history. I'm reading Penn Jones' book. A party was held there. J. Edgar Hoover, task force commander, conferred with his troops and issued the last-minute instructions to review the final plans and give the world to go or to cancel as necessary. Now, in the obituary of J. Edgar Hoover, I'm going to mention this quotation from Penn Jones' book, and there's one to four more books we'll talk about on this show that just came out. One is at the publishers. One has been out about 2 months. To show you where J. Edgar Hoover was in American history, what was coming down on him at this moment, and why his staying on this earth, either what he did would give him a heart attack or he was no longer useful to the Richard Nixon campaign. And I'll tell you how that group were in, Nixon's group were in on the killing of DM and on the killing of Joe McCarthy. And they come down on the people that they use when they can't use them any longer. There's a book out besides Penn Jones' book on Forgive My Grief. There's a book out that I talked on our radio show about 2 weeks ago called The Texas Mafia. It's at the printers now. And this book, the discussion of it in the newspaper said, this book blisters the Texas tycoons from Lyndon Johnson to Clint Murchison. That's the very wealthy oil man that J. Edgar Hoover was associated with all the time at Corona Del Mar on the racetracks and had many, many deals and close associations with Clint Murchison. The book ties the White House occupant, which is Richard Nixon, and all of their under-table deals with J. Edgar Hoover. That's called The Texas Mafia, Forgive My Grief. It has the story of the conference of Nixon, Murchison, and Hoover the night before Kennedy was killed. The Texas Mafia has Lyndon Johnson, Murchison, Nixon, and Hoover. Hank Messick, the book I just referred to, and I'll read parts of it on the program as much as we have time. I want to cover a certain order here first, is a new book by Hank Messick called John Edgar Hoover. Now, Hank Messick has studied organized crime. I've read several of his books, and I've ordered some more. He has written The Silent Syndicate, Syndicate in the Sun, Syndicate Wife, Syndicate Abroad, Secret File, and Lansky. He has written a book called John Edgar Hoover, showing the continued relationship of crime and business and politics, of the syndicated crime, the racetrack people, organized crime to J. Edgar Hoover, starting with Meyer Lansky, who was put into Navy intelligence again. That goes back to Navy intelligence. And
book published just this year?
It just came out about a month ago by David McKay Company, New York. It just came out.
Fortunate timing for the author and publisher.
Yeah, on the back cover of the book, it says, for a half century, John Edgar Hoover, unique among Americans, had the power to destroy the infamous syndicates of organized crime, and he failed to use it. Instead, as crime grew in the nation's biggest business, Hoover used his power to enhance his reputation and that of the FBI. Sworn to defend the country, he was unable to distinguish its true enemies. Posing as a moral leader, he helped create a generation of cynics. Under the guise of fighting subversion, he encouraged those on the right who distrusted democracy. Perhaps his greatest disservice has been to confuse the American people about the real nature of organized crime. Instead of admitting it was an economic problem, he said it was a moral issue and assured the public it did not pay. It did handsomely and largely because of him. That's from John Edgar Hoover. Now, another book...
Is that to implicate him as an accomplice to organized
crime? Oh, absolutely. Or? He worked hand in glove with organized crime.
Hoover, what did he get out of it?
Hoover had tremendous power. You see, he helped men in the distilling business like Rosenstiel, Lou Rosenstiel, and during the time of the Prohibition. Lou Rosenstiel has a J. Edgar Hoover Foundation and museum, and they have publicity, you know, and speakers acclaiming the glories of J. Edgar Hoover. He got into the early bootleg at the time of the Prohibition thing. What he got out of it was the orderly succession of power, and this book also goes into, we'll bring in another assassination someday, because there's a man on the peninsula who knows about it, and I have his name on the arsenic poisoning of President Harding. And that was the beginning of Hoover's career. And the man who wanted to tell who killed Harding was put in jail by J. Edgar Hoover. Hoover worked his way up from the early days, you know, in 1924, on deaths and scandals and locking up the people who would tell the truth. And this book goes into the fact of how Harding died of, in quote, acute indigestion, and there was no autopsy performed. And Hoover put a man in jail who wanted to tell the story of the Harding murder and had him locked up. Hoover worked his way up by hiding people that should have been exposed. It's an interesting book. And it says he built, over the decades, he built a secret organization subject to his whim or will. One of the things Hoover did, he was a very religious person as a child and always was, and went to church, and he did not sign up in World War I when Woodrow Wilson asked all the young patriots to go to war. He didn't go to war, but he had something like a scout uniform, and he'd wear it to church services. He went into the Justice Department when everyone else was going off to war as a young man and got a deferment, you know, didn't have to go in the service. He stayed patriotic from inside the early Justice Department, and he worked his way up. It's a very good book on how he worked his way into power and what he got out of it. He got tremendous prestige, and because he was very religious, and the communist revolution threw out God as well as the Tsar, that was his natural enemy. You know, he took an antagonism to communism very early so that he could create a love for Nazis as against communists. And it was all tied in with his theology, I'm sure, that his goal was to always go after the communists. So the organized crime and Nazis and other kinds of people, extreme right wing, were no problem to J. Edgar Hoover. They weren't a threat. And he had a thing to fall back on, because if you criticized him, he said you were a communist. you couldn't find fault with him because he had this wonderful cover story. Like Dr. Spock made the remark when he passed away this week, it's about time. So the media said only the radicals are criticizing him. Nobody else would do it. Only the communists or the leftists would ever take a dig at Jake, you know, because you have to be a left of center to criticize him. Well, these books are his record. This is where it's at. These aren't all written by left of center by a long shot, and his record will begin to pour out. Now, this book, Lansky, is another book by Hank Messick, and it ties in J. Edgar Hoover and the syndicate, an organized crime, but it's different than the one on that Messick wrote on just Hoover, because he throws in Bieber, Rebozo, Richard Nixon, Smathers of Florida, and Lyndon Johnson as being all of the same team. This is a very heavy book, and this is what I've been trying to say is happening all along, that these men have a very close relationship that needs to be examined. There's a new book coming out, which I don't have yet, by Peter Noyes, called Did the Mafia Kill JFK? And this is about syndicated crime, J. Edgar Hoover, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard Nixon. Now, you see, how much are Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon going to take of this? You see, J. Edgar Hoover is being discredited down the line. And he's old, and he's an embarrassment because he should have retired, but Lyndon Johnson wouldn't let him when he was 70. And he's an embarrassment to Nixon.
What do you mean he wouldn't let him when he was 70?
Well, you turn in.
The story
in.
That got out was that Hoover didn't want to be resigned.
Well, what you do, you turn in your resignation because the law reads, or the civil service, that you resign. And Johnson said, no, I can't let you. You're the most valuable man in the country. He wouldn't accept the resignation. That's why he wouldn't let him. He may have gone through the formality. You see, he wanted to live until his great monument, that FBI building, was dedicated and in his honor. And they could give him the accolades that they did Lyndon Johnson at that library that we talked about last week. There's some talk that he was going to be buried in that FBI building. I think it would be fitting that he should be, but they probably won't do that. I didn't read the paper where the final decision was made. But this book by Peter Noyes has to do with Mafia, Hoover, Johnson, and Nixon. And you have to keep in mind that all these books are bringing in Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon wants to be president in 1972. He wants to be elected. And Richard Nixon has risen up over the ashes and bones of a lot of people. We've talked about the political assassinations, and I feel that his responsibility should be exposed in his lifetime. But he's running for election, and everything's timed in election year. And as these books pour out on J. Edgar Hoover, they have to be an embarrassment. Now, this week, the article came out on Jack Anderson in many of the papers on the briefing of Lyndon Johnson of the sex habits of various people.
Right, that story came out just the day before Hoover died.
The day before Hoover died, and the day that Hoover died, there were more in the paper the day before it came out, and then the following day, the papers were filled with it. And the L.A. Times had a front-page story on the 3rd, May the 3rd, said, Johnson's bedtime reading. Anderson assails the FBI secret love memos. Well, for those of you who follow Dialogue Assassination regularly, I have always emphasized different aspects of the political assassinations. And one show I did when Gloria was still here was on the sex habits of various public officials and how the Washington hierarchy uses them to gain votes or electoral votes, not electoral votes, congressional votes, and affect the minds of various members of Congress. And Bobby Baker was notorious with this, with his purple suites. He had girls dressed in purple, and I heard the stories of have articles, purple carpeting and rugs, and ran whorehouses. And Lyndon Johnson would entice these particular public officials into these various whorehouses that Bobby Baker ran. This was the story. And then Bobby Baker was the Secretary of Congress, and he'd hand out how people were to vote on certain situations. We've talked about Howard Hughes, the greatest voyeur of them all, who had a wall in Las Vegas with 40 cameras on it. And he had a switch button, and he could see within every 2 inches of Vegas. And you could set up all kinds of conventions and things and get public officials there on junkets or meetings, and they could be photographed or documents kept in all these compromising positions. The sex habits of public officials has been one of the ways that J. Edgar Hoover has decided to effect votes in Congress to get what he wanted, appropriations, to keep people from being active in civil rights positions, taking certain stands. And when I completed my 8 years research on the John Kennedy murder and was ready to sit down and write the outline I have for 5 books, the head man above all the research, more important than where the bullets and rifle were purchased, was a man named Frank Capel. And Frank Capel is a writer. He is in Army intelligence. He's written up in the Warren Report on Volume 15, page 718, 19, 723, page 725. Frank Capel wrote a little book called The Strange Death of Marilyn Monroe. And it has he implies that Robert Kennedy had a part in murdering her, but Frank Capel and J. Edgar Hoover loved to watch the Kennedys, and it wasn't hard because they were hopping from bed to bed like there was no tomorrow, you know, and they could control Robert Kennedy. You see, he was the Attorney General, and it was my feeling, based upon all the evidence I had of J. Edgar Hoover's watching them through Army intelligence and through his agents, that when John Kennedy was killed, Robert Kennedy was blackmailed to not do anything. You see, in the Justice Department, you had Robert Kennedy as the head of the Justice Department, and under him was J. Edgar Hoover. Supposedly, the FBI is under the head of the Justice Department. But by having the goods and blackmailing Robert Kennedy for so many things, and there was this terrible hatred because Hoover and Robert Kennedy just hated each other. They didn't talk to each other at all. I felt that one of the reasons that Robert Kennedy never went into the actual evidence of who killed his brother was the heavy blackmail that Frank Capel and J. Edgar Hoover had on him. They kept the truth from being told. Because his own personal life, his family, his reputation, his desire to be president someday were blocking the truth, where his obligation was to the country as the head of the Justice Department. And this book by Frank Capel goes into the fact that he wanted to be president someday, and that his relationships with these women, that Frank Capel could keep, he kept the information of his relationships with them, particularly Marilyn Monroe, and her death, the circumstances of her death. We did one show on that. But I wanted to show that when the Anderson story broke on the voyeurism of Lyndon Johnson, who at night went to bed with these reports, these sex reports on various people who had no arrest records at all. These men had a hang-up on sex that was unbelievable. And I have one file on single men involved in the assassination. That doesn't mean that men who are single have to be involved in political assassinations or espionage or intrigue. But the major figures in the political assassinations were single. The men who were involved, these bachelor types like Hughes and J. Edgar Hoover and David Ferry, Jack Ruby, General Walker. There's a whole team of men, it goes to about 30 men that are single, that play Shaw.
What's the significance of being single?
Well, there's a book Wilhelm Reich wrote on the origins of fascism, and it's 300 or 400 pages. And the theory goes into, he's talking about German fascism. He came from Germany and left when the Nazis came. And his feeling was that the lack of sexual compatibility or orgasm is diverted into legalized hostility in the form of repressions. The people that hurt enough will join uncivilized political parties and do terrible acts as a means of expressing themselves. Wilhelm Reich is a well-known psychiatrist, and the origins of fascism is just into that subject. So when I talk about a fascist takeover in this country, and I look at the people who are named and their voyeur habits, and they're really strange, I'm just mentioning a few, but there's a whole lot of them I have at home, you know, that I pick up, and they fit into this classification that Wilhelm Reich was talking about. Now, these people that were watched by J. Edgar Hoover with their sex life, they had no police record at all. There was no file on them. The L.A. Times had an article. I have 3 articles here from the news this week. Love affair, no matter how sordid, is no business of the FBI, the L.A. Times was saying, and so was Jack Anderson. Yet the FBI demonstrated their intense interest in who was sleeping with whom in Washington, and President Johnson was one White House occupant who had a fine appreciation for stories about the extracurricular lives of public figures. Hoover happily prepared secret memos loaded with intimate details about personal affairs of the high and mighty, and that was President's bedtime reading. He had reports, we know, on Martin Luther King, but he kept them on Marlon Brando, Harry Belafonte, Joe Namath, David Abernathy, and these were signed reports by J. Edgar Hoover, and there was no security involved. They were not by the White House. There was no reason to follow these people, except that this was their particular little hang-up to watch the sex lives and love affairs of the prominent. So Hoover had a delight, and he named Lyndon Johnson. Now, Johnson isn't funny. When I talked about the War Council last week, Lyndon Johnson isn't to be messed around with, and neither is Richard Nixon. And I don't think they like a cover story that says Johnson's bedtime reading. Richard Nixon was not interested in these little stories. Nixon's a different classification. These little earthy stories about bed hopping are not Richard Nixon's cup of tea. There's a fine line that we can go into while we discuss J. Edgar Hoover that I talked about before, and that was when Howard Hughes moved into Las Vegas. I did a lot of one show on that subject, that I felt that in this country, which had become a police state but needed to tighten its controls, that Howard Hughes moved in there to squeeze out the FBI and the mafia, and that there would be a friction in the next 4 years between the mafia, the syndicate, and J. Edgar Hoover, which I described in what they're thinking is like a counterculture, ethnic groups, Italians, Jews, you know, the low-level robbers with their skimming money. And Howard Hughes, who owns 1/50th of our country, one state, and has the largest defense contracts, I guess, of any person in this country, is closer tied in with the heads of government than any one single man, working with the moon and the submarines under the seas. Howard Hughes, with Intertel, which is international police force, and Interpol, would come into Vegas and begin to tighten up the control on J. Edgar Hoover. At the time he moved in, I didn't know that Robert Mayhew of the FBI was running the gaming tables at Las Vegas. But Mayhew has been crying, you know, he wants his job back, and everybody's hurting at Vegas, and they're not having any fun anymore. The international police are watching what's happening, and things are tightening up. This is part of the tightening process. And I predicted that Richard Helms, who is the chief grandmaster of this clandestine system, a lot of people are never familiar with his name. You don't read much. He's the head of your Central Intelligence Agency. He was brought up in very fine academies, not like J. Edgar Hoover. He went to Europe. He's met Adolf Hitler. He worked with John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles in the OSS. It became the CIA. He worked with Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's head of Eastern European development and intelligence, who formed our CIA. Helms was a protege of Alan Dulles. There's no civilian head of the CIA. Richard Helms is that man. And to me, he epitomizes everything, like Howard Hughes, with his Mormon aides, his five men dressed in white, and everything sterile and clean. Hughes and Nixon and Helms epitomized to me the systematic, robot, fascist, all-business kind of person. They're not voyeurs in the other sense. They're dangerous. They're more dangerous. And the equivalent, and we'll go to this on the second half, the equivalent of Richard Helms coming down on J. Edgar Hoover is like Richard Nixon coming down on Joe McCarthy. McCarthy was useful to Nixon, but he was an embarrassment. And he had to crush McCarthy and be in charge of his defeat, because McCarthy was sort of an earthy big mouth who talked a lot. And he was an uncoordinated fascist. And I'm going to read part of an article, a description of Nixon and McCarthy by Emil D'Antonio. He was an earthy, incoherent, he had no party. Nixon has a party. And it's lined up with the German cartels, John Connolly, the people down in Jamaica, the headquarters. And it's time. This is why, Phil, I say it was time, if Hoover didn't die a natural death because of all the exposés coming out about him, then he had help coming along. But the exposés aren't coincidental either, because when you want to expose the CIA, you just don't do it. There was an article in the paper this week about Mr. Machete. He worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. He's a free citizen of the United States. He wrote one book called The Rope Dancer, and he wanted to write a book about the Central Intelligence Agency. But when you want to do that, it goes to the judge at Alexandria, Virginia, where the Central Intelligence Agency is. And Judge Albert Bryan, Jr. declined a protest from the American Civil Liberties Union that no other nation's history has ever done. No other judge in the nation's history has restrained the publication of fiction. This is a book by Victor I. Marchetti on the Central Intelligence Agency, written in the form of fiction. And the book will not be allowed to be published. His earlier novel, The Rope Dancer, came out, and it was written up in Ramparts and Computer and Automation. Marchetti is the man who claims that the Central Intelligence Agency in South Vietnam killed 17,000 civilians in order to make Mr. Thu look like the candidate of their choice. Not army people, but politicians, news people, ordinary citizens that did not like the regime, just like people do not like the regime in Athens. And Marchetti claims that the assassination squads from the Central Intelligence Agency killed 17,000 civilians in South Vietnam.
Okay, we'll pick up more about J. Edgar Hoover and his friends after we identify the station you're listening to. This is KLRB FM, Carmel, on the air 24 hours a day.